Thanks to all of the Dukies in the house this morning. Let me first say thanks to your dean here of the Divinity School, Gail O'Day, and the committee that put this lectureship together. Thank you for your invitation and for taking the risk, perhaps, of inviting a Bapticostal into your midst. Don't let it fool you that even though I'm at Duke Chapel, that I have not lost my roots. Also, I'd like to thank all of you for coming, the alumni, local pastors, staff, students who are present here with us, and particularly, I'm glad to just be in the number this morning with my homiletical colleagues, Tom Long and Anna Carter Florence. Anna represents what the prophet Jeremiah has said, that the word was like fire shut up in her bones. And she is a fireball preacher, and her work, particularly I would say on testimony, is really a gift to the Guild. So thank you, Anna, and for Tom Long, the living legend, who has been so kind to me since seminary days, actually, throughout my own journey. So it's grateful. I'm glad to be with him again on this occasion. The sense of place is our theme for this conference. And I might suggest for just a brief moment that the sense of place that we may have may actually be a sonic space. Hush, hush, somebody's calling my name. Hush, hush. Somebody's calling my name. Oh, hush, hush. Somebody's calling my name. Oh, my Lord, oh, my Lord, what shall I do? Future of Faith, retired Harvard Divinity School professor Harvey Cox asserts that we are now in what he calls the age of the spirit. One reason for his comment is due to the number of people who have distanced themselves from being called religious because of skepticism toward institutional and doctrinal religion. Today, many prefer to refer to themselves as spiritual. I am a spiritual person, but not religious. The term spiritual affirms a way of life rather than a system of dogma. It is a pathway to speak about human experience of the divine. Even within theological education these days, there is a warmer embrace of spirituality, or at least Christian spirituality. The proliferation of conversations about spiritual formation in seminaries is evidence of this. Another reason for Cox's assertion should be common knowledge these days, that the shift of the world's Christian population has moved from the North to the global South, or as a former colleague of mine says, it is turning brown and heading south. This shift has been due to the tremendous growth of Pentecostal communities worldwide, communities that emphasize physical experience of the Spirit. The majority of Christian churches in sub-Saharan Africa and numerous parts of Asia are Pentecostal. The largest Christian congregation in the world, the Yoido Full Gospel Church, is in Seoul, Korea, which claims 800,000 members. This makes Joel Osteen's church look like a mini church. To add to this, grassroots Pentecostal and charismatic movements in Latin America are also on the rise. These charismatic Pentecostal communities talk about a spiritual fire of the Holy Spirit expressed primarily in the worship experience. Writer James Baldwin's father was a Pentecostal preacher. And in his essay, Down at the Cross, A Letter from a Region of My Mind, in his book titled The Fire Next Time, he describes the Pentecostal experience in his father's church and writes, I have never seen anything to equal the fire and excitement that sometimes, without warning, fill a church, causing the church to rock. I might add that there are churches with this fiery flavor that may not only rock, but they roll in money and economic prosperity. Connected to the rise of Pentecostalism in general is the rise of the prosperity gospel in particular. Many preachers within this theological school of thought stem from spirit traditions. For them, to be spiritual is linked to capitalistic material gains through consumeristic means. So preaching has become a big business in this sector of Pentecostalism. Glamour and glitz glare through various media forms as some print preachers pimp the gospel for financial profits. When high-tech marketing or branding of a certain type of spiritual beauty dominates, then an aesthetic of prosperity becomes an ethic of prosperity. And in this spiritual marketing strategy, the flaunting of one's material wealth and physical health is a validation of the Christian faith. This so-called prosperity gospel, which has become an important part of North American Christianity, is a version of consumer culture. Thus, the more one possesses materially, the more it is obvious that one is blessed by God and is doing God's will and is truly spiritual. Because of this lens of prosperity, one continually asks for more to get more. It is a love affair with more. Marvin McMickle observes in a critical way that in prosperity gospel churches, every passage of scripture serves as a passport to a bigger house, a larger car, or an expanding bank account. He questions the apparent celebration of the exorbitant and self-indulgent lifestyle that is avidly pursued by an increasing number of preachers in America, often as a result of milking and bilking their congregations through some prosperity gospel scheme. McMickle is not alone in his criticism. Social ethicist Robert Franklin declares that the implicit muting of prophetic ministry by the proclamation of prosperity has helped to create a crisis in the village. He writes, if most black preachers, and other preachers for that matter, are preoccupied with pursuing the bling-bling life of conspicuous consumption, then poor people are in big trouble. I would add that not just poor people are in trouble, but that anyone experiencing existential pain and suffering on any level is in big trouble. This so-called spiritual gospel promotes a kind of pain-free religious experience. Thus, pain is not a part of the gospel. One cannot deny that masses of people adhere to the prosperity gospel, and that it's popular, as is evident through its permeating presence on different media outlets. Who would not want your best life now in this world when all one has possibly known is suffering? Or as Jonathan Walton, the new minister at Harvard's Memorial Church, writes, Though in my mind God offered liberation from racial and gender injustice and capitalist exploitation, I saw other preachers seemingly get further with a Jesus who provided the keys to the kingdom in the form of a four-bedroom house and a Mercedes-Benz. In a 2006 Religious and Ethics News Weekly interview, legendary prince of the pulpit, Gardner Taylor, was asked to assess the current preaching scene. What he says is illuminating. He declares the following in that interview. There is now a tendency, I think, more than ever, to make it a kind of Sunday Chamber of Commerce exercise. Motivational speaking, which has its place, but is not the gospel. It becomes a kind of opium, if opium is a stimulant for people, which gives them often a false notion of what life is all about. I think much of contemporary preaching does not prepare people for the inevitable crises of life. When we talk constantly about prosperity, well, life is not constantly prosperity. It has adversity and difficulties, and if one is trained, conditioned to see only the bright side of things, then one is not prepared for living in this world. Of course, people want to hear it, because candy is a very pleasant thing. My daughter lives out in Harbor City, California, and when she was a little girl, I suppose we could have fed her candy morning, noon, and night, and she would have taken it morning, noon, and night, and enjoyed it. Soon she would have had no teeth, and soon we would have had no daughter, I think, because candy is wonderful. I love it, but one needs in one's diet more than candy. Taylor's notion that a prosperity-only message is like candy suggests that this type of theology and preaching is initially sweet to the taste, a pleasant thing, but in the end it is detrimental because life is not just about the bright side of things. If one chews on this prosperity message enough, one will end up with no teeth, because one needs in one's diet more than candy. Prosperity preaching may be sweet like candy at first, but it will eventually be sour for the soul and bad for one's spiritual teeth and nerve. Candy homiletical theology does not sustain people's lives in the end because it does not take into consideration what life is all about. The hardships and pain of life tend to be muted in this bright, sunny gospel. It is a false, distorted picture of the gospel if death and sorrow are ignored. In fact, it represents an anorexic pneumatology with a thin theology of death. The prosperity preachers may be wise and right in taking the Spirit seriously, but I believe are wrong in their practice of the Spirit, because as far as I know, the Spirit led Jesus into a wilderness and Ezekiel to a valley of dry bones, a place of contamination and death. Thus, one might say that just as everybody talking about heaven ain't going there, everybody talking about the Spirit ain't got the Spirit. In light of all of this, then, what might a spiritual mode of preaching be? Where might we look to glean spiritual wisdom for homiletics? I believe this age of the Spirit provides an opportunity to incline our ear to the musical literature in African American religious history known as the spirituals, to have a better understanding of what is spiritual and what it might mean to preach in a spiritual mode. It may behoove us to tune our homiletical melodies to the key of the African-American spiritual mode. The spirituals are theo-homiletical paintings of the human soul in the color of music. They are musical sermons, and as such, we gain knowledge about homiletical theory and practice from them. In my book, Dem Dry Bones, I discuss the historical linkage between the creation of the spirituals and preaching events. Both spirituals and preaching are musical. and both contextual and textual and communal in nature. One might even say that singing preaches and preaching sings. Or as the queen of gospel music, Pastor Shirley Caesar, says, "I sing my sermons and preach my songs." The spiritual homiletical tradition has much to offer about preaching in a spiritual mode. Thus, in the following, I will linguistically play four notes that may echo in a fruitful direction for the ministry of preaching. First of all, a spiritual mode of preaching. And this is so relevant as I looked at this morning's headline news on US Today as we hear of more terror attacks in Kenya, in Pakistan, as we, in the wake of the shootings in Washington, D.C., and even on the streets of Durham within this last week, and even as we continue to hear about Chicago and the violence on the streets, a spiritual mode of preaching sounds the note of the reality of human suffering. Soon we'll be done with the troubles of the world, the troubles of the world, the troubles of the world. Soon we'll be done with the troubles of the world. Going home to live with God. No more weeping and wailing, no more, oh, no more weeping and wailing, no more, oh, no more weeping and wailing, going home to live with God. The spirituals teach us that human tragedy, death, pain, and suffering are a part of human life, thus a critical component of preaching. No one escapes the troubles of the world. To remember the spirituals means that one remembers a deadly, bloody, tear-filled past in human history, unless one suffers from cultural amnesia. The spirituals are musical memorabilia created on the anvil of misery. We have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading a path through the blood of the slaughtered. Tears, blood, and death, not health, wealth, and prosperity, have been the heart of the existential journey of oppressed people in the world. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of faith, says Princeton historian Albert Rabateau. And for my homiletical purpose, the blood of the martyrs fertilizes the soil of our preaching. Preachers stand in their blood to preach. Their blood cries out from the pulpit every time we stand to preach because they have paved the path of proclamation for so many people. To be spiritual is to embrace the human condition of suffering. Suffering must be lived through. Preaching in a spiritual mode tells the truth about tragedy and death as aspects of the gospel. If not, it is a doxological lie that promotes homiletical dishonesty because African diasporic cultural memory is moist with bitter blood. Pneumatology is not devoid of agony, groanings, shrieks, moans, even from the belly of slave ships where lament danced and swayed. Spiritual preaching is not sorry for the sorrows of humanity, because this is the way life was and is for many. However, pain is lamented. Thus, preaching in this mode laments the sorrows without forgetting the joys. Yet it recognizes that it is not possible to explore the spirit of life without facing squarely the reality of death. The spirituals remind us that death and suffering must be dealt with in our preaching and not ignored. Our lives depend on it because to pass over these sorrows imperils humanity as well as theology. Theologian Sean Copeland can say this because not only our cultural memory, but Christian theological memory is drenched in blood and includes a God who suffers, even though many of our hymnals would like to remove the blood of Christ. Therefore, secondly, a spiritual mode of preaching sounds the note of a theology of divine suffering. Calvary. Calvary, Calvary, oh, Calvary. Spirituals teach preachers that pain and agony are even a part of God's story. The spirituals remind us of a God in the flesh, Jesus Christ, who never said a mumbling word as he suffered, bled, and died on a cross. When one sings the spirituals and listens to their sermonic discourse, one has to deal with the reality of a God who dies. Because death is no respecter of persons. As the spiritual declares, death ain't nothing but a robber. The Christ dies. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when they nailed him to the tree? Were you there when they pierced him in the side? Were you there when the sun refused to shine? Were you there when they laid him in the tomb? The mantra of "were you there" brings you there to the place of suffering and pain. It cannot be avoided even when one follows Jesus, unless with our hearts drunk with the wine of the world we forget thee, including the memory of suffering and blood. Our theological memory is washed in the blood of the Lamb. Preaching in a spiritual mode reveals that preaching is not spoiled by tears, for at the heart of the proclamation of the church is a bloody death. Eating the bread and drinking the cup of communion is a proclamation of the Lord's death. The Eucharistic table is a table of death, about, as James Cone would say, a lynched word, even a lynched black body. So Jesus died gangster style, like all of the crucified peoples of the world. He was on crucified lockdown, confirming what one theologian declares, that the Spirit does not make Jesus a Superman. If the cross is our spiritual lens, then catastrophe and tragedy are at the heart of gospel preaching in a spiritual mode. This theological perspective suggests that preaching has drops of blood all over it, as preachers proclaim a lamb standing as if it had been slaughtered. Death keeps Christianity real and connected to the way it really is in the spiritual life. There are no resurrections without crucifixions. This divine and human suffering, which are an aspect of God's story, are critical because they are the theological roots of preaching. God enters the world and takes on its suffering, not just regular suffering of all creatures that grow old and die, but the suffering of the innocent, persecuted by the unjust, the suffering of abandonment and seeming failure, the suffering of love offered and refused, the suffering of evil apparently triumphant over good. To avoid this kind of suffering is to ignore what it means to be human and what it means to proclaim an incarnate God in a spiritual manner. Third, a spiritual mode of preaching sounds the note of an ecology of community. Get on board, little children, get on board. Come on, little children, get on board. Little children, there's room for many of you. Get on board. Little children, get on board. Little children, get on board. Little children, there's room for many of you. The spirituals reveal that suffering and death are a communal experience. We are joined together by the baptism of suffering's tears. Preaching in a spiritual mode evokes the idea that tragedy, pain, struggle, and death are felt in the collective body, the entire community. There's room for many a more. One of the verses says there's no second class. There's no rich and poor there. There's no second class aboard this train. Spiritual preaching includes everyone in the joys and sorrows. All experience suffering on some level. As humans, we belong to communities with histories. The so-called individual experience is really a part of a larger communal narrative. The performance of call and response of the spirituals, also evident in much of African American preaching, reveals the communal essence of black communities, that when one suffers, all suffer. All engage in the pain because of what Paul Gilroy calls the ethics of antiphony that permeate the Black Atlantic. Preaching in a spiritual mode fosters an antiphonal communal identity. Now, what is most important is the radical inclusive nature of community, such that there is a rich intersubjective dynamic in a preaching community that goes beyond the performative dimensions. This mode of preaching affirms the human spirit and reaffirms a crucial insight of slave preachers, that every human is a child of God. One scholar notes that slave Christianity was an alternative to slaveholding Christianity because its theology and anthropology were thoroughly non-racist. Even the nature of the spirituals themselves point preaching to a communal ideal. The spirituals are folk songs with no specific author or actual place of origin. There are no specifics about the composer or lyricist because they are the community's sermons. The common good is most important. Thus, one might say that preaching in a spiritual mode is a collective exorcism of selfish individualism. This homiletical understanding may actually help congregations reclaim their singing voice as a community. And this brings me to my fourth note. A spiritual mode of preaching sounds the note of the viability of the practice of singing as a homiletical strategy. I'm gonna sing when the Spirit says to sing. I'm gonna sing when the Spirit says to sing. I'm gonna sing when the Spirit says to sing and obey the Spirit of the Lord. I'm gonna sing when the Spirit says to sing. I'm gonna sing when the Spirit says to sing. I'm gonna sing when the Spirit says to sing and obey the Spirit of the Lord. Oh, I'm gonna stand when the Spirit says stand. I'm gonna stand when the Spirit says stand. I'm gonna stand when the Spirit says stand and obey the Spirit of the Lord. Oh, I'm gonna clap when the Spirit says clap. I'm gonna clap. Shout the when the Spirit says a shout. I'm gonna shout the when the Spirit says a shout. I'm gonna shout the when the Spirit says a shout. And obey the Spirit of the Lord. I'm gonna preach when the Spirit says a preach. Come on, preachers! A preacher when the Spirit says a preach. I'm gonna preach when the Spirit says a preach. Time, I'm gonna sing when the Spirit says sing. I'm gonna sing when the Spirit says sing. I'm gonna sing when the Spirit says sing. And obey the Spirit of the Lord. And obey, and obey. So you were just warming up on Get On Board. You didn't know what was coming. But this fourth note and the viability of the practice of singing as a viable homiletical strategy. The spirituals reveal that sermonic singing is a vital and necessary response to situations of suffering. It has been said that in the cotton field, the machete was dull without a song. It has been said that songs are free even while in oppressive chains. It has been said that you can't sing and not change your condition. It has been said in the early church, he who sings prays twice. It has been said the gods will not descend without a song. It has been said to sing till the power of the Lord comes down. Singing was a sign of the slave's refusal to be stopped. It was a nonviolent weapon against oppression. The song itself, in the words of Pauli Murray, was hope in a weary throat. Thus, preaching in a spiritual mode sings, hums, chants, moans, intones, hoops. Singing is possible and preferable in painful predicaments as a sign of life, hope, and the presence of God through human voices and bodies. This is so much more than the commercialization and commodification of musical voices and bodies in a bling bling business. Singing is deeply spiritual and deeply human in the face of the proliferation of disembodied technologies. The spirituals show us that singing is a matter of life and death, revealing the weight of the ministry of preaching. Singing in a spiritual mode is not art for art's sake, to perpetuate a capitalistic and consumeristic society. Singing is life in the crucible of suffering and death. The spirituals were not just songs of the soul, but they were life itself, essential for survival. Singing was living and life was a song. So preaching in a spiritual mode understands that if we don't sing, we will die to the sting of suffering. There was much crying and screaming and groaning and moaning in Haiti in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake. But there was also lots of singing. Anne Azizi, a 70-year-old woman, had been buried for a week in earthquake rubble that was at least 3 stories high from the ground. And when she was pulled out of the rubble, she was seriously dehydrated, as you can imagine. And she had a broken leg and dislocated hip. She was suffering. And when they pulled her out of the rubble, she didn't ask about her 401k. And when they pulled her out of the rubble, she didn't ask whether she had any unread emails. And when they pulled her out of the rubble, she wasn't interested in all of the blog chatter about Oprah Winfrey's new TV network. And when they pulled her out of the rubble, she didn't care whether her rescuer was Republican or Democrat. Because when they pulled her out of the rubble, coming down the rubble, Enna Zizi began to sing. Her body was worn, and her throat was weary, but hope and life were singing. Preaching in a spiritual mode will sing out of the rubbles of human existence. These 4 notes, the reality of human suffering, a theology of divine suffering, an ecology of community, and the viability of singing, do not encompass the entirety of the spiritual theomusical corpus. Yet they help us hear what it might mean to be spiritual today in this age of the Spirit, particularly as it relates to preaching. I have attempted to remember the past in order to remember the future of preaching. This lecture has been a work in memory, even counter-memory, to some spiritual, economic, exploitative preaching practices. Most of all, I have offered a memorial to the many thousand gone, because we should not forget the bridge that brought us over. The door of the past cannot be closed, and in the case of the spirituals, it should not be, because there is further development and growth needed in our theory and practice of preaching. To forget them is to lose the deep spiritual roots of preaching. But to remember the spirituals and their creators is to honor them. Remembering is the preacher's duty, according to some homileticians. And I remember those African peoples who brought, in the words of W.E.B. Du Bois, the gift of story and song to America. And in conclusion, I honor the creator of the spirituals, the unknown Black bards, by reading James Weldon Johnson's 1922 poetic ode, O Black and Unknown Bards. O Black and Unknown Bards of long ago, how came your lips to touch the sacred fire? How in your darkness did you come to know the power and beauty of the minstrel's lyre? Who first from midst his bonds lifted his eyes? Who first from out the still watch, lone and long, feeling the ancient faith of prophets rise within his dark-kept soul, burst into song? Heart of what slave poured out such melody as "Steal Away to Jesus"? On its strains, his spirit must have nightly floated free, though still about his hands he felt his chain. Who heard great Jordan roll? Whose starward eye saw chariot swing low? And who was he that breathed that comforting melodic sigh? Nobody knows the trouble I see. What merely living clod, what captive thing could up toward God through all its darkness grope and find within its deadened heart to sing these songs of sorrow, love, and faith and hope? How did it catch that subtle undertone, that note in music heard not with the ears? How sound the elusive reed so seldom blown, which stirs the soul or melts the heart to tears? Not that great German master in his dream of harmonies that thundered amongst the stars at the creation ever heard a theme nobler than Go Down Moses. Mark its bars, how like a mighty trumpet call they stir the blood. Such are the notes that men have sung going to valorous deeds. Such tones there were that helped make history when time was young. There is a wide, wide wonder in it all, that from degraded rest and service toil, the fiery spirit of the seer should call these simple children of the sun and soil. O black slave singers gone, forgot, unfamed, you alone of all the long, long line of those who've sung untaught, unknown, unnamed, have stretched out upward seeking the divine. You sang not deeds of heroes or of kings, no chant of bloody war, no exulting paean of arms-won triumphs, but your humble strings you touched in chord with music empyrean. You sang far better than you knew. The songs that for your listeners' hungry hearts sufficed still live. But more than this to you belongs. You sang a race from wood and stone to Christ. Those black slave singers, gone, forgot, unframed, untaught, unknown, unnamed, were singing preachers without a portfolio, who preached far better than they knew because their sermons sing on today and provide homiletical pearls of wisdom. Those who were unlettered, the underside, the marginalized, the other, taught preaching quite unlike any seminary or divinity school. We don't know their name or face, but they have contributed to the history of the world, music, and preaching. So I've remembered the dismembered to remember preaching in a spiritual mode. At their wellsprings of knowledge and at the altar of their souls, preachers may drink and bow to learn what one did not know or could not know about preaching without them. Their musical sounds of sorrow and joy are a haunting echo that still reverberates down the acoustical corridors of homiletical history. And as we hear the echo, may we try to tune our preaching to its spiritual mode so that we too may run the spiritual race from wood and stone to Christ. And as we run, may we sing, Lord, I want to be a Christian in my heart. Lord, I want to be a Christian in my heart.